Good morning. Welcome to hour number two, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be looking at American history and going back to a period around the time of the Civil War, roughly speaking between 1830 and 1900, and the man who is at the center of this period, a man certainly who is at the center of this period, and that is Abraham Lincoln. Americans before the Civil War believed that it was possible to build the perfect society. Not only did they believe it was possible, they believed that they were going to do it and it would be happening here on American soil. The problem was that different people had very different visions of the perfect society, and as we saw with the war, they were willing to go to war and shed blood to see their visions preserved. We'll talk a little bit this morning about this time in American history, about Lincoln's contribution, and the argument that our guest, Vernon Burton, makes in his newly published book, The Age of Lincoln, which is that Lincoln's contribution certainly was abolishing slavery, but goes beyond that. More important, he says, was Lincoln's commitment to the idea that freedom was a personal right to be extended to all Americans and backed up by American law. The book has just come out. It's published by Hill and Wang. The book is titled The Age of Lincoln. And we're very pleased that he can be with us to talk about it. He's professor of history and sociology here at the U of I. Has been here before on the program once or twice to talk about his work, and we're very pleased that he could be here with us again. 333-9455 is the number if you'd like to call here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I think that I would like to ask you to talk, as a way of starting, to talk about millennialism. As a spirit that had America in its grips at this time, what exactly that meant, and then perhaps we could go on and talk about competing visions of what people thought America should be, could be, would be.
Well, for the millennium, it really goes back, of course, to the Bible and the idea of completing the perfect society. And part of it, as you know, I start with the minister Miller, with his idea that, in fact, there was a certain day that people believed in. It's just one example of many of the sort of utopian perfection ideas in America. The real belief that this was, in the Puritan terms, a city on a hill that could show the rest of the world and that American society would be able to move that way. One of the things that fascinated me so much about this time period is, of course, the very time period we're living in. As a person of faith myself, I saw the development of religious fanaticism in the 19th century as strongly influencing events. And I think that's sort of a fact that deserves underscoring, particularly as I now see danger in the extremes of religion currently just influencing our policy in the United States today. And I saw a very similar pattern, beginning with the idea of millennialism and then the commitment that this is the way and the only way to perfect society.
Yeah. So I think that I'm sure that one of the great challenges that historians face is trying to be able to see the world as much as one can through the eyes of the people of the past. And I think that one of the values of this book, I think it helps us to try and recapture a little of the worldview of these people who did indeed have this idea that America was going to be the highest point, the fulfillment of what mankind could be, and that God would smile on that, on us, and that we would be this shining example to the rest of the world. And you could see that if that's what you thought you were moving toward, why people would, the lengths to people would go to see their vision, and the vision of, generally speaking, of Northerners and Southerners was so polarized, as you explain it, as you move through the years coming up to the war, any middle ground that might have been there once was gone. And so the what people thought was at stake here was enormous. It's almost hard to probably to overestimate just what people thought was going on here.
And you can see the centrality of why Lincoln, which starts in his 1837 or 1838 Lyceum speech, one of his earliest talks, the importance of law and how law would be central to holding together a society when people had such different views. It was one of his earliest worries as he pondered the idea of democracy, which he so believed in, and how could it work, is his concern about extremes or fanaticism. And he gives examples, and that's where the idea of the law works in for Lincoln that I think is really central and has to be understood. I think one of the great books on Lincoln is by the University of Illinois Springfield historian. He's actually got more than one, but Phil Paladin, and particularly the one where he looks at Lincoln's commitment to the law and having to understand Lincoln as a lawyer, but even before he was an attorney, his understanding of law and that you could change laws to make them more fair, but it was the only way to hold a society together and work toward justice. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that wasn't the case that people on both sides of this divide somehow thought the law was already on their side?
Well, yes, or they called to a higher law was the calling on both sides. And one of the things I tried to show is the amazing shift. We think of the higher law coming from the abolitionists before the war. But in fact, at a certain point where the South, that is, we shouldn't just say the South, because the South, I try to show, was very divided. It was very varied in terms of people's commitment to the Union and others. But where they had always fallen back upon the Constitution and the law, they shift and start calling upon a higher law as well, moving away from the law. At the same time, it seems to me the abolitionists, the main thrust of the movement, begin to see the importance of the law, as Lincoln did, in changing the laws and to get rid of slavery through the system in place of laws. So it's an interesting shift there.
And I suppose also it made it more difficult because even when you appeal to higher law, and here what people would be talking about would be the law of God, not the law of man, still, people felt that the law, that God was on, everybody felt that God was with them, was on their side.
That's right. That's why I think Mark Knoll has hinted in his wonderful book on religion in America before the Civil War. I'm probably putting words in his mouth, but if he doesn't believe it, I certainly do, that in fact Lincoln was probably the greatest theologian of the 19th century because he understood that God's will was not necessarily the same as one's desires or that God was on your side. And so I find that really fascinating. I also find that his corporate belief in religion is much more similar to African American coming out of the culture, both slavery and free African American before the war and certainly after the war. In fact, one of the arguments that I think is fairly unique is that it is the African American community which are the real inheritors of Lincoln's idea, not mimic him, but take him their own way, of both the belief in law to change society and an understanding of the corporate God of a people as opposed to the individual God that would single out a person in a way or individual salvation as opposed to the salvation of a people or salvation of a nation and understanding how God works in history. I found that part. We could talk forever. I don't want to go on, but obviously I'm fascinated by that aspect of Lincoln.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Vernon Burton. He's a professor of history and sociology here at the University of Illinois. And if you're interested in pursuing more of his thoughts here on the subject we're discussing, look for his new book, brand new book. It's titled The Age of Lincoln. Hill and Wang is the publisher. It's just recently come out. Looking at America around the time of the Civil War and the importance of Abraham Lincoln in changing the way Americans thought about very basic, I'm sure people would have said, were very basic notions about freedom. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And there I think it's the point that you make, I think, is that there really was over this period, and Lincoln was very instrumental into it, a change or perhaps at least a struggle over what people meant when they used a word like freedom. From the point where it meant something like, it was very centered on the individual and that individual's liberty to live as they chose. And I suppose if that meant owning other people, well, so be it. At least at the beginning, the founder said something like, well, in order to get everybody to sign on to this project, we're going to have to decide we're going to fight this battle some other time. So it was a very, very almost radical kind of interpretation of personal liberty. So you see some kind of shift from that to this idea that no, individual liberty doesn't trump everything, and that Lincoln was very important in pushing and advancing that change.
Well, I think you described it exactly as I intended to write it. I tried to tell this story as a story of freedoms rather than of the enslaved's emancipation, which is where the literature has been for quite a while. To me, that way, the 19th century makes much greater sense. For one instance, of course, the centrality of a meaningful vote becomes so glaringly obvious, and this is particularly true in Reconstruction in the years following and even today. And, of course, you and I have talked on other occasions about my work as an expert witness for minority voting rights, and so a lot of this thinking comes out of my own experience in the courtroom and working in the courtroom today as an expert witness and reading back to understand the intent of lawmakers at that time and understanding how they came up with these ideas or what they intended with sort of the incorporation of the 13th, 14th, particularly the 15th Amendment into the Constitution.
Yeah.
And I see that, of course, as, you know, this great legacy of Lincoln, an extraordinary legacy as we move from the Constitution of sort of restraints to empowering, giving people the right of something instead of reserving the rights to the states.
We have a caller. Let's bring them into the conversation. They are in Champaign on line one. Right here. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling Professor Bird. This is fascinating. I guess I'm going to buy your book. But I remain conflicted by Abraham Lincoln. I grew up in a small town in southern Arkansas. In fact, I went to high school, all-black high school named Lincoln High School, named after Abraham Lincoln. And in my house, I recall we had three pictures, Abraham Lincoln, John F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, Jr. But as I've studied Lincoln by reading, and a recent book really gives me a problem with whether or not your thesis is correct about Lincoln's desire for freedom for all, including people of African descent, and that is Lerone Bennett's Forced into Glory. Are you familiar with that book?
I am, and Lerone's a good friend of mine. I think it's a wonderful book.
Well, he doesn't paint Lincoln in a very positive picture, if I remember correctly, basically saying if Lincoln had his way, Michael Jordan, Oprah Winfrey, and I assume a peon like me would still be in the shackles of slavery or voluntary servitude. Am I reading that correctly? He is not very complimentary about the Emancipation Proclamation because he said it did absolutely nothing. And some other things like compensated emancipation and whether or not blacks coexist with whites. It's just, and I view it as a negative about Lincoln's yearning desire for freedom for all people, including people of African descent. Now, I'm going to let you respond to that, so maybe you can eliminate some of the conflict I feel at this point.
No, I think you should feel conflict, and in fact, I think we all should. Lerone Bennett has been one of my heroes since graduate school, and I say something in the notes, which are actually on the web, about the importance of his book on Reconstruction, how important it is. And in fact, in October, the first week in October, I'm commenting on a paper that Lerone Bennett's given on Sojourner Truth, Abraham Lincoln, and Frederick Douglass at the annual meeting of the Association for African American Study, Life, and History. It gives me a chance to think about that a little bit. Let me just start by giving the other side. The other side, the way historians have looked at Lincoln, is somehow he was born without a racist bone in his body. And therefore, you know, he is, quote, the great emancipator. And this is, you know, before Lerone Bennett and others, many African Americans sort of accept this view in the sense that you pointed out growing up in Arkansas, having the picture of Lincoln there as well. What I try to show, and I think this is the truth, like all of us, at least we hope, and one of the reasons I believe in education and I'm teaching is that Lincoln changed over time. Lincoln grew. There's no doubt that Lincoln was racist, but he grows extraordinarily. And I think, you know, Lerone and I just differ on the interpretations at times. And this is something historians will debate a long time. I would never deny that Lincoln was racist, but I also think it's wrong to say that he did not grow in terms, very rare, I think, for presidents in office in particular, so that he becomes less and less racist to the point that he thinks the only way to preserve freedoms for African Americans is, in fact, to move toward the vote, which is very radical at that time, particularly for someone to be able to be elected president. I don't want to run on and on because I want to get your response as well. But I think that we do a disservice when we don't think that people can change. And Lincoln, in that way, almost becomes heroic to me because he shows that with studying a situation, he can change. The great example, of course, is Frederick Douglass, who talks about this in his autobiography and other places. And you can find Douglass has been quoted on this both ways. But I think he genuinely means it when he says that, in fact, when he comes after the second inaugural to the White House, he's invited. Now, that in itself is an extraordinary thing for the president to invite an African-American. And remember, at this point, he has moved from probably the pack of where Americans stand on race relations to ahead of where people stand on emancipation and on freedom and where African-Americans' place in society should be. They'd stop Douglass at the door. And Lincoln sees this because they think, you know, an African-American shouldn't be there. So what he does, he says very loudly so everyone can hear it. He says, "There is my friend Douglass." He walks over and shakes his hand and says, "Douglass, you're the man. I would like your opinion of my speech because I value your opinion so much more." And it was a way of Lincoln, who is a very careful man in what he said and what he did, of elevating African-Americans, particularly through Douglass. So that's just one example. And I have dealt with this question you're asking about in the book, and I'm trying to give a thumbnail sketch of what you yourself have suggested, I think, is a very complex situation. Racism itself in America today is still complex. It was then even more so, except that most people saw no shame in it. And so to see Lincoln moving away, particularly as a politician, who had to somehow keep America together, I think is an incredible story of a politician who's wrestling both with his own moral values and changing them and bringing the country along as well.
Okay. One last point. And I don't know, but I thought there was some plaque at the U of I at some building, and I'd heard that Lincoln once said, and maybe this is just a part of the evolutionary process he went through, that if I could save the Union without freeing the slaves, I would save the Union. Is that an apocryphal? Is that apocryphal, or did he in fact say that?
He absolutely did say it. One of the problems with Lincoln, I learned studying him, and I'm sure I've got some things wrong too, is how much is attributed to Lincoln that he probably didn't say. I think Tom Swartz, who's a state historian and for a while was the acting head of the Abraham Lincoln Museum in Springfield, does a wonderful thing of sort of list of things that are attributed to Lincoln that he never said. But he indeed did say that. But he went on to say, and this is often quoted, but part of that same letter that is quoted off and off to Horace Greeley goes on to say that he himself has always personally been opposed to slavery and that he wants to get rid of it. And he says to the people he's writing this to, and he publishes this letter publicly. He sends out the letter. He doesn't have to, but so he wants people to see it. And he says to them, you know, bring the rest of the nation along so that we can, in fact, get rid of slavery. But it's, I think it's absolutely true. If he could have saved the Union, that was his top priority. But you can just see the complexity in that very letter, and it's one of the problems of taking just one phrase out of it away and not having the whole thing there.
Thank you, Professor.
All right. Thanks for the call. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Vernon Burton. He's a professor of history and sociology at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. His new book is The Age of Lincoln, published by Hill and Wang. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. In the time before the war, members of Congress, at least some of them, were struggling to try to find a way to maintain some balance between the interests of the slave states and the free states. And here, again, we need to remind people that just how much there was that divided the North and South. I mean, they were radically different cultures. One, and certainly they were divided by their economic models, one being industrial and one being agrarian. And there was this concern of how can America expand and at the same time maintain this precarious balance between the two? And eventually it got to the point where it was just untenable. Maybe it never was. I guess that's the question. Was the war inevitable, or could somehow that delicate balance have been maintained, maybe at least for a couple of more decades?
Well, if slavery, of course, that was the issue, and slavery in the territories. One of the things I tried to show in the book, and maybe didn't do it as clearly, is the interesting, before you begin to focus on the sectional conflict of North and South, the real concern between North and South was not about their culture. They were closely tied together economically. Cotton drove the economy. They were worried much more about the West and how it would fit in terms of it. And there was almost as much concern among particularly Northerners and Southerners about the capitalism and the individual and the development of capitalism and sort of unfettered capitalism until it shifts so much on the moral issue of slavery, I think. And there's an old debate, too, you know, would slavery have died out? And it certainly did in Brazil some 20 years after the American Civil War. But what's interesting is we think of the years after the Civil War, particularly after Reconstruction, as an age of segregation. But one of the huge differences is that if it had died out naturally that way, it could have very easily institutionalized, in fact, the kind of situation that was in South Africa, that is, build it into the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It could have retained, you know, sort of institutionalized racism in the laws of the country. With the Civil War, I think Lincoln's greatest sort of contribution is, in fact, the installation of not only freedom, but the rights of equality and the right to vote, which I think is central. I mean, absolutely central to understanding the years afterwards when people debate the failure of Reconstruction. I mean, there's, I think, way too negative idea that it could not have succeeded. I try to argue, in fact, that it was succeeding in many ways on many levels, as long as people had a meaningful vote, that is, African Americans. So it's complicated, but as long as slavery was not there at the fore. This is one of the more interesting arguments, and I should have spoken to the gentleman from Arkansas. One of the main arguments I make in the book is, in fact, that you have to understand that Lincoln was a Southerner. That to understand Lincoln, you have to understand that he really had many values of Southerners, but it's different Southerners than we think of as planters, though I see him aspiring to some of that as well as many that came out of the yeoman white South as well, particularly this sense of honor and how he grappled with that. But the great irony, of course, is that people like Seward, who was seen as much more radical than Lincoln, were willing, in fact, to let the South go. They were. It was only, I think, this is part of my argument, that probably no other politician but Abraham Lincoln would have felt compelled that he had to keep the Union together and would not allow the sort of extension of slavery outside of where it existed at the time. And it becomes sort of a matter of honor, like the wrestling match I talk about that I love so much with Lincoln as a young man, or the duel that he almost fought for a sense of honor, where he goes all the way to an island in the Mississippi River.
He kind of stacked the deck on that duel. I don't know.
Yeah, I love
maybe
that.
He thought he really was could finesse his way around that. But he went, I guess maybe if it had come down to it, he might have actually been there swinging the sword with his opponent. Well, I think this is an interesting point, because when you say something like you really have to I have to see Lincoln as a Southerner, as someone with Southern roots, for us, we think of him as being ours and an Illinoisan, and we don't particularly think of Illinois as being the South, although Southern Illinois is definitely in the in the South. We just don't see him in those terms. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about when you say something like here, you really have to understand Lincoln was a Southerner and that his roots were Southern roots. What exactly that means?
Well, after teaching 33 years at Illinois and with my own Southern background, and I've always argued there was a lot of the South in Lincoln, and this is contested too. Some recent literature argues that there's a lot of sort of the Yankee Massachusetts heritage that he has some of the same values of, but I think it's partly that historians haven't understood the South. The country itself today is still captured by this romantic myth of the planter South that comes from movies like in books like Gone with the Wind, as opposed to the diversity in the South. And Lincoln was treading, I think, a well-known path that had been trod before by yeoman white Southerners on their way up toward what we would think of as middle class or even trying to reach planter status. If you notice, the women he was always in love with were from the South. The Springfield, to show you how Southern, in fact, Illinois was, Springfield was originally named Calhoun after none other than John C. Calhoun before it becomes Springfield, which becomes Lincoln's hometown. His family, his father left Virginia, and then from Virginia, of course, to Kentucky, where he's born. One of the fun things to do is just think he's born within 100 miles where Jefferson Davis is born. What would have happened, of course, if Lincoln's father had headed down, Thomas Lincoln had headed to Mississippi, and maybe Jefferson Davis' father had headed toward Illinois, but then into, of course, Indiana, and finally into Illinois, which becomes his home. And I think Illinois is rightly to claim Lincoln. He does make it his own coming to terms with who he is right here on the frontier and the changing frontier of Illinois. But I think those roots as a Southerner and his understanding of what he thought the South was is crucial to understanding Lincoln. And I talk a lot on different occasions on different subjects about how much I love that Lincoln is adopted by Illinois, the land of Lincoln. What an absolutely great identification. There's a new book out that sort of pokes a little fun at this, the Ferguson book. But when you think that most people learn their history not by reading my book, The Age of Lincoln, or any other book I have read, but they learn their history by, in fact, what people tell them are important. The historic house there, where this happened, those sorts of stories, where markers are up. In my hometown of 96 South Carolina, the only marker was there was a marker for Preston Brooks having beaten Charles Sumner while he was sitting down on the Senate. So every little black and white boy growing up in 96, maybe the girls too, figured the way to get to be famous, have a marker and beloved is just take a cane and beat somebody senseless in the Senate. So I think it's a wonderful heritage that we are the land of Lincoln, because I think Lincoln stood for extraordinary values about democracy. And as I mentioned before, his belief in or the fact that he himself changed, was able to grow, continued to grow all his life. It's sort of funny. I was talking to somebody the other day. You don't think about Lincoln the way he has a patent, the way he loves technology. Lincoln would have probably been a computer geek today. They couldn't, when he was in the White House, he spent so much time just looking at new things, what he wanted to do in terms of technology, but a fascinating, fascinating person. I really see him as the fulcrum of this period, 1820 to about 1920, this period that I call the Age of Lincoln. It's sort of how it folds around him on either side.
Let's talk with someone else. Let's go to Urbana, line number one right here. Hello.
Good morning, Professor. This is a great interview. I've been doing some informal, casual scholarship of this period on my own, and listen to other writers on this subject. Personally, right now, I'm reading Uncle Tom's Cabin for the first time in my life. And in Mr. Gates's annotated version in the preface, apparently this book was the first runaway bestseller in American publishing, I think. And as I read it, with some other background reading, it is the author uses every gimmick and contrivance of the professional writer to make her point in no uncertain terms. So that's got to figure in into the age of Lincoln. And I noticed Ms. Stowe is quite favorable toward the Methodist denomination in her anti-slavery position. I agree with it wholeheartedly. But what surprised me, again, in reading Mr. Gates's annotated version, is how quickly the country was eager to read her words. Could you comment on this?
Yeah, and I spend a good bit of time, because I think you're right, this book is central. You know, it's one of these things that, whether Lincoln said it or not, the little woman who started the war, it's one of these things we probably will never know. But this is, you know, claimed that Lincoln said it. And in some ways it's true. You know, she claimed that she didn't write the book. God did. He sort of spilled it out. She comes out of a remarkable family. It's just an amazing family. And I have
quite a radical for their time, were they not?
They were. And I have quite a bit on the family themselves there. She's the daughter of ministers, married to ministers. Her brother is, there's a book that won the Pulitzer last year, The Most Famous Man in America. Henry Ward Beecher, the preacher, and in fact, she gets ahead of him. What, of course, and this goes back to David's earlier statement, what inspires her and a number of other people in the North is the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act. Now, there'd always been a Fugitive Slave Act in the Constitution, but in this Compromise of 1850, which Illinois' Stephen Douglas had so much to do with, we bring in the Fugitive Slave Law again, and it's brought there. And for the first time, really, it's going to be enforced. And it means that Northerners can no longer just say this is a Southern problem, because they are now involved in slavery. They'd always been involved in slavery. Slavery was a national phenomenon. But it had died out pretty much most places. But now, when runaway slaves were, in fact, caught, they had to actually help bring them back, and you couldn't stop.
Well, it was a little more than that. Apparently, slave catchers would grab any African American, including, I guess, the most prominent African American preacher in Philadelphia, and try to cart him off to the South.
That's right. There was a lot of stealing. It was a lucrative market. It's just like today with drugs. If people can make money, they're going to find a way to do it. And this was one of the ways these slave catchers made a lot of money. They would and part of the book deals with this. There are attempts to stop them. There's a free black community that in fact kills some slave catchers who come into the community. It's an interesting story. But this is really brings Harriet Beecher Stowe, her brother, and many other Northerners feeling that they are directly implicated in slavery itself. And in this process, I think it really changes the attitude in essential ways. The book is, as you said, is interesting. She takes some of the things that that Dickinson was doing in England, the sort of the changing situation. You have your hero die instead of coming out on top in the end. There's even a little bit of a fascination with pornography there that you can see that Americans develop in their literature.
I'm not sure I read that in the in the preface, but I'm not sure I'm going to agree with Mr. Gates on that one.
Well, it's not pornography in the sense that you might think of on the computer or on some of the cable channels. It's the idea of the beatings, and particularly the powerful masters or whites being able to take advantage of the implications. It's not overt, but it was this sort of teasing of things that's there. But all these were in some ways sort of new in American literature, and along with the great moral story that goes there.
Well,
I have students read this book. I mean, I've taught it over and over again because I think people need to read the book. It's a powerful, powerful book with a moral story. And, of course, Uncle Tom is not what we think of after the Civil Rights Movement, this accommodationist Uncle Tom, but he is the idea of Christian manliness that was being developed in the North. He is hero in the Christ-like sense. It's a story. And, of course, you don't get the at the end of the book, you don't get the wonderful feeling.
I'm not quite to the end of it yet.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I shouldn't give it away. That's part of where we're going.
I know the tragic ending, but I can see where she is leading us. Now, in contrast to some of these ideas, we have the diarist from the South, Mary Briscoe Chestnut, and the biographer of Stephen Douglas, Dr. Johansen. You probably know him. No?
Well, I know Bob Johansen and have great admiration for him. Of course, Mary Boykin Chestnut is Boykin Chestnut. And one of the interesting things, you should get the revised biography by C. Van Woodward. We now know that she was quite a wonderful prophet because she rewrote her diary for publication.
Yeah,
so she had a good sense of what was going to happen. So you have to read that with a sense of care. And there were a lot of novels. My wife and I think it was on the show with you, David, my wife and I brought out a novel on filibustering that I had found. The only one copy was left in 1854 was published, which is like many books in the South were written in response to the Uncle Tom's Cabin. There are a number of famous ones, but there are a lot of not famous ones. The quality just wasn't there to try to respond and show how wonderful slavery was and how happy slaves were, this sort of creation of the myth of the happy slave.
And recalling the book Complicity, how the North supported slavery, there was a scientific basis for racism purported by Professor Agassiz at Harvard University in a couple of decades before the Civil War. He printed out this, published this great treatise, and it was accepted by the scientific community, which has, you know, totally changed since then. But it left a real nasty legacy, which later racists, including I presume Nazis, could pick up on.
Oh, yes. In fact, Hitler was very fond of the Confederacy. But you're right. And in fact, part of this is the whole development of what's called a pro-slavery theory, which is one of the sad things that happens to the white South in particular. They ransacked every single area of life, whether it was history, science, everything, to argue, in fact, that slavery was a positive good. This really changes starting in the 1830s, primarily because of the attack, I think, of abolitionists on slavery, and it becomes a moral issue. And one of the things I think we probably have learned from both the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement, Vietnam, you probably don't convince people that they're wrong and convince them to change by telling them that they're morally corrupt or evil or whatever else. We saw a little bit of that with the contentious issue of the Illinois chief as a mascot, that it just draws lines more, and that's one of the things that happened. But really, the South in particular ransacked every area, particularly intellectually, to buttress this argument that slavery was a positive good.
But does your book focus on the radicalization of the South, beginning with, you know, first you have the nullifiers, and the attempt to by John C. Calhoun just to take South Carolina out of the Union?
Yes, it starts with these things and with the central of Calhoun. One of the things I argue interesting about Calhoun is he was always wanting to keep the Union together. He's seen as the radical. What he wanted to do is preserve slavery, but he's a fascinating person. It's his speech in Congress about 1838, I believe, that really sets out the first. Slavery is positive. We have been, you know, for a long time apologizing for it. Now we're going to argue that it's a positive good.
Thank you very much.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Vernon Burton is our guest. He's professor of history and sociology here at University of Illinois. If you'd like to read more about this time in American history that we are talking about, you can look for his book. It's brand new. It's The Age of Lincoln. It's published by Hill and Wang. And we have some other callers here we'd like to bring in. Let's go to someone here on our line number two, and this would be in Urbana. Hello.
Hello, Professor Burton. I wonder if your book addresses a topic which I rarely, if ever, hear discussed with regard to Lincoln, and that is his order to have 38 Indians killed in Mankato, Minnesota, in at some point in his presidency.
It does, but the amazing way that I look at this again, and, you know, it's rare, I think. I've looked at other people that when you study someone, you become more and more liking them as opposed to looking at their faults. Originally, in fact, I forget how many, I have to look in the book, but it was probably 200 were on the list to be killed.
Right.
Lincoln, during the middle of this war, takes the time to go through and read all of this. In fact, he orders them not to do anything to the Native Americans who are accused. And he goes through and only those that he finds evidence for that they have committed murder or things like this are the ones that he allows to do it. In fact, he pardons the others, and there is this statement from Minnesota politicians saying, you know, you're going to lose the election if you do this. And Lincoln says, and I would rather lose the election than to do what's wrong. So, again, it's like with the racism. It's there in both ways. You must remember that the rest of America would have wanted to kill every single, not the rest, but an awful lot. Majority opinion people were ready to sort of exterminate all the Native Americans. He, as he did often, probably too much micromanaging in the Civil War itself, went through very, very carefully so that only those that could have conclusive proof that they had committed the most heinous of crimes or murder themselves would actually be hanged. And, of course, this is a time when people are dying everywhere in the Civil War. And that reminds me, because one of the things that happened, someone mentioned Professor Johanson, and Professor Johanson is one of the reasons I actually came to the University of Illinois, because I wanted to learn from him. He is a truly great historian, and he's done so much to revive the reputation of Stephen Douglas. Now, we have, though, different agreements. I said Lincoln has really has become a hero, and I believe we do need heroes in America. My generation of historians were some of the people who came along and sort of showed those feet of clay. I was one of them. We said, you know, Thomas Jefferson had slaves. He more than likely had enslaved children. Therefore, he's all bad. Not, in fact, separating out that he was able to write something like the Declaration of Independence. It transcended his own ability to live that way and look at it. And in Lincoln, I really did discover a hero. And to understand why Lincoln's a hero, I think you have to look at someone like Douglas. So this goes back to the first caller from Arkansas. Douglas is arguing for white supremacy. Douglas is arguing, in fact, that white supremacy is the only way. And you have Lincoln, you put Lincoln in context, then it's heroic, it seems to me, for him to argue against slavery, for inclusion. So it's the perspective of the historian. It's one of the dangers of taking people outside of their context. And Douglas was much more popular than Lincoln and much closer, I think, to where the rest of America was. He was much more mainstream and much more reflecting the views on race that America was. And it helps us understand where Lincoln was and his racism to put him up against the man that he most is famous for in his debate and being contrasted with at the same period and the same time.
Great,
it was Douglas who was seen as the great man at the time, not Lincoln.
I'll read more about it in your book then.
Right. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We'll get one more caller here. We'll go to Champaign County. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi. I want to return to Lerone Bennett and his work, Forced into Glory. Actually, I saw him in the belly of the beast at the old State House debating at a Lincoln Scholars event, on a Lincoln's birthday event, and I thought he handled himself masterfully, despite the fact that he was really being vilified and being attacked in very unfair ways, it seems to me. One of the things that I found most persuasive, and in just the moments we have left, was, and particularly in the context of your talking at the beginning about Lincoln's dedication to rule of law, Lerone Bennett seems to have found evidence that Lincoln, without authorization from the Congress, which was mainly a radical Republican-led Congress, diverted monies to keep a Negro removal office open. This is sort of patterned on the idea of the Indian Removal Act, and the idea was that he was still thinking, even in this very late part of his term, that he was going to be able to send Negroes back to Africa, which really undercuts, I think, a lot of the arguments made about his, you know, progress in his... he came a long way, obviously, because he used to love to tell darky jokes and all that. So, But I just found this one particular idea or the thing that Lincoln did very very subversive to the mythology. If you would, please.
Yes, and in fact, I think, again, you need to look in context. And, you know, again, I really like Lerone Bennett, and as I pointed out, particularly on Reconstruction, his Black Power book is, I think, wonderful. I, you know, read him in graduate school on the early work and have always followed him. Plus, he's a Morehouse man and dedicated to another one of my heroes besides Lincoln, Benjamin Mays. So it was only with fondness that I take issue with him. For Lincoln and a lot of people, colonization was in fact seen as a very moderate compared to what the rest of America would like to do. He was also looking for colonization to the West. He was trying to figure it out. You've got to remember there were people like Martin Delaney, black radicals who were arguing similar things as well. And I think he moved well beyond that. The more he got to know someone like Frederick Douglass, who would express his opposition to it, then I think Lincoln was willing to change to the point that he was, at least I argue in my book, that by the time of his assassination, he's saying pretty bluntly that you are going to have to give the franchise, total citizenship, to African Americans. He's writing that privately. He makes that famous speech a few nights before he's killed, and John Wilkes Booth hears him, knows exactly what he's saying in this coded message, and says he means, you know, in a racist way, John Wilkes Booth expressed it, but black citizenship, black rights, and black voting. So colonization, sure, we look at it, I look at it as totally inappropriate, racist, but if you consider what it was at the time and Lincoln looking for a way, as he thought it, to keep a balance, to find a way for a country to survive, to find a way where African Americans would not be discriminated against and could be citizens. This was one of several alternatives he was looking at. I don't see it as the linchpin of Lincoln's racism at all. I see it as part of his searching for a way through law, through a way that can make society work. Understand that racism was a very real thing in American culture and society.
I'm going to have to jump in here because we're to the point here we have a minute or two. Can you say in that much time, you probably can't, what made that change occur? I mean, why did he change in that way? You're making the argument that, in fact, he did change. And if he had not been killed, who knows where that would have gone. Do you have some sense of why that change occurred?
Well, again, when I say change, remember Lincoln always said, and I think it's probably true, that he was always anti-slavery. His father left Virginia, Kentucky, getting away from slavery. He hated slavery. It's the same thing of why I think Lincoln becomes the greatest theologian. Remember, he sort of mocked religion in the same way he made fun of it. He got in trouble as a little boy because he would, in front of his friends, he would mimic the preacher, and he got in a lot of trouble later on about whether he was religious or not. But then as he grows in the White House, he turns into someone whose faith, I think, can't be questioned. Not that he was a Presbyterian, Methodist, or anything else, but a person who began to wrestle with issues of faith in that way. And I think the same thing with race. He didn't think of race because of not knowing African American. He thought of slavery. As he got to know and dealt with these issues of race and fairness, he had this sense of fairness, a real sense of fairness. Once African Americans had fought in the Civil War for Lincoln, I think there was no way that he, or for the country, not for Lincoln, but Lincoln and they, there was no way that Lincoln could go back and say that they should not be citizens. Not the way that Lincoln thought, not the way that he believed in justice, not the way he believed that the law was central to keeping the society together and working within the law. And if people had done their duty, showed these things, whether they were property owners, he said early on, you know, if somebody owns property, this is back when he was a Whig, when it's a huge jump from the idea that only people who are propertied should be able to vote. He said if they serve their country, this is well before the Civil War, then that was part of it. And to move to all white male suffrage, and then finally to, I think, inclusion of all people for the right to vote.
We're going to have to stop. Much, much more in the book if you want to read it. It's The Age of Lincoln. It's just out. It's published by Hill and Wang by our guest Orville Burton. Orville Vernon Burton, he's a professor of history, sociology here at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I do want to say there's a lot, and I very briefly on the period after the Civil War, more than half the book, and that's very important. We have done a disservice to history because we sort of see the Civil War isolated. Reconstruction is part of the Civil War. It's a continuation. It can only be understood that way. Thank you so much, Dave. It's always fun to be with you.
Programs here on WILL AM made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, the 2007-2008 season brochure and KrannertCenter.com announcements of the 2007-2008 season of guest artists will be available by the end of June. We are broadcasting from Kemble Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. Just a quick mention before we go that tomorrow, in the first hour, we will be talking with Steve Vogel. He is a military reporter for the Washington Post, and he has authored a new book about the building of the Pentagon. Not really talking here about the Department of Defense, but the book itself. We'll be talking about that book, The Pentagon, A History, tomorrow morning at 10. Then also we'll talk with Nathan Tublitz. He's co-chair of the Coalition on Intercollegiate Athletics. He was also professor of neurobiology at University of Oregon. We'll be talking about a recent report that's come out about the reform of intercollegiate athletics. That's tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour. And, by the way, before we go, let me also mention that our guest, Vernon Burton, will be doing a book signing of the new book, The Age of Lincoln, and that's scheduled for this weekend on Saturday at Pages for All Ages.
Right.
In the afternoon?
I believe it's 2 to 4.